This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
FM 89.9 on the evening edition. You're with Kelvin and Hezril. And first up, we're looking at Prime Minister Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin's press conference on the RMCO. So to quickly recap, Tan Sri Muhyiddin started off by summarising the economic measures implemented so far. This includes the Prihatin and Pinjana stimulus packages, loan moratoriums, wage subsidies, and the reopening of most economic sectors.
Additionally, the Prime Minister reminded everyone to not be complacent. While the number of cases has been controlled, we need to avoid a second wave. A second lockdown would severely impact the economy and people's livelihoods.
On that note, he said that the government is considering making mask wearing in public mandatory. Parents, employees and community leaders need to do their part to remind those around them to wear masks, wash their hands frequently and physical distance. Tan Sri Muhyiddin stressed that the fight against COVID-19 isn't over and that everyone should continue doing their part to curb it.
So in light of all this, we thought this would serve as a good checkpoint on where things stand. It's been more than a month since the RMCO started. Most businesses have reopened and traffic has pretty much returned to pre-MCO levels. And while we've managed to control the number of new cases, Health DG Datuk Dr. Noor Hisham Abdullah reminded Malaysians that this is far from over.
Yeah, so you might have seen, you know, the social media posts about more people not wearing masks, for instance, or how more places are failing to enforce physical distancing. So we want to see if the government needs to adjust their approach, especially since they're planning to open our borders to green countries. And also in light of the fact that the latest clusters are mainly from imported cases.
Yeah, so lots going on. And I think very timely, I guess, in light of some of the, I'd say, shifts in public attitudes, the perhaps the complacency. It's very timely that this announcement comes, I think, you know, just to remind us that it's far from over, and that I guess I'm also glad the Tan Sri Muhyiddin reiterated the need for you know, community leaders to remind those around them and I guess remind Malaysians that it's up to us at the end of the day to take charge of this and make sure that you know, we do our part in curbing it.
Yeah, for sure. So you can let us know, how have you been, how effective do you think have Malaysians been following the SOPs? Are we still pretty good at it, or have you found that we've been just a bit lax? You can call us 7733 2900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio. After this, we're going to cross over to physician and health policy specialist Dr. Koh Swee King for his thoughts on this. You can send in yours too. In the meantime, we are headed to some messages. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is 5:11. You're with Kelvin and Hezril on the Evening Edition. So we are just looking at the Prime Minister's press conference earlier on the RMCO. So I think the biggest point from that is, at this point in time, the government is considering making mask wearing in public mandatory. Mm-hmm. The rest of it were really just to serve as reminders as to why it's important for us to continue complying with the SOPs. So we're going to now have a look at how the RMCO has been overall, as well as Malaysia's policies in general when it comes to dealing with the pandemic. And to do that with us, we're crossing over to physician health policy specialist Dr. Koh Swee King. Dr. Koh, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
So what's your overall impression of the Prime Minister's speech? Do you agree with the main points that he brought up?
Yes, I do agree with the main points that he brought up. I thought a reminder from the senior most leader in Malaysia is necessary at this point. We are now a few weeks into the recovery MCO, which will be followed very soon by the normalization MCO. And there's a general sense that Malaysians have started taking the pandemic for granted. Outside our borders, it is raging. We may have about double-digit cases in Malaysia and a slight uptick with noticeable number of new clusters. That's nothing compared to what's happening in countries like Brazil or Mexico or India or the United States. So while we can see that the situation in Malaysia is doing well compared to other countries, it could have led to a situation that we're becoming more complacent and we're resting and we're thinking that this pandemic is over. It's not. It will only be over once we have a vaccine. And therefore, the timing of the Prime Minister's speech and the main points that he's brought up that are reinforcing the need for us to continue to be vigilant is very timely.
Hmm. And how do you think the country has fared so far under the RMCO, both in terms of controlling the number of COVID-19 cases and reopening the economy?
We are fortunate in the sense that we've got about 5-6 months of data. And as we look at the data, Malaysia has done well. In fact, I might even say that Malaysia has done very well in the entire COVID situation in terms of controlling the number of COVID-19 cases. Let's look at the numbers just as a rough guide, right? Malaysia in total, cumulatively to date, has got less than 9,000 cases. In America, although the population is, of course, 10 times more than Malaysia, they have 60,000 new cases per day. And that's an unimaginable number. An equivalent to Malaysia of 60,000 cases per day will be something in the order of 8,000 new cases for Malaysia per day. And this is a clear indication that Malaysia has done well in terms of controlling the number of COVID cases. Also, the shall we say, the total number of deaths. And all this is a result of the public health measures and the strength of the Ministry of Health Technocracy. In terms of reopening the economy, I think the numbers are still open to question. Our unemployment numbers are going higher in the month of May compared to previous months. We're not yet in a technical recession, but it's possible that we may slip for our economic forecast for the year of 2020 and 2021. And I think it's too soon to tell how successful we are in reopening the economy.
Right. And looking at the main point of the message, I guess, from the Prime Minister, which is that the government is considering making the use of face masks mandatory. Where do you stand with the enforcement? So far, I think the Health DG, on his end, he specifically said that, you know, if we do make it mandatory, the problem is that the penalty might be too much for some sectors of society to pay for.
This is true, and I, in general terms, agree with the Health DG. But maybe I'll begin a longer elaboration, if you permit me, by first stating that the intention is to get people to wear face masks. That is what we want to achieve. Now, the question then becomes, is a law the best way to get people to wear face masks? It is one way, of course, but this is potentially Malaysia's fascination with magic solution, and we often reach for the law in order to achieve our policy objective. Now, let's remind ourselves, we want people to wear face masks. And to get people to wear face masks, we might not need a law. So I do not stand for a law in order to enforce people to wear face masks. But I'll continue by saying that if we do have a law, there is a good and there is a bad component to it. The good component is that it indicates that the government is very serious. A law means that it sends a message to society to wake up that there is no room for complacency. And that's good if we do have a law mandating face masks. But there are also negative consequences of a law that mandates face masks. There would be, firstly, a disproportionately large penalty of 1,000 ringgit. Obviously, we can make it smaller, like 50 ringgit. The number doesn't matter to me for the moment. But the principle of it is, how do we make the proportionality of the punishment equal to the crime itself, assuming, of course, that not wearing a face mask is a crime? Secondly, the second negative consequence is that we're shifting a lot of police resources, administrative, implementation, enforcement, logistics. Instead of fighting crime and corruption, we're asking the police to enforce face masks. And I'll argue that this is not a good use of the police's time. The third one is obviously what I mentioned earlier, that we're reaching for magic solutions, as though that if we create a law and implement it overnight, even assuming there's a 100% implementation and 100% justice, and we know we can't achieve 100% in either category, we think that there will be a magic solution to it. Therefore, I net out at not having a law. If the intention is for us to get people to wear face masks, I offer two solutions. The first one is leadership by example. This means that people outside the Ministry of Health, political leaders, senior technocrats, CEOs of companies, leaders of non-governmental organizations, religious organizations, community leaders, Ketua Kampung, for example, all need to lead by example, not just the Ministry of Health. And they can lead by example by wearing masks, by whenever they post up pictures on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, that they are indeed masked. And I think leadership by example is one concrete solution. The second concrete solution is to go back into public health. And in public health science, we talk a lot about using emotions in order to change human behavior and to get them to adopt new practices. Now, emotions are very complicated, obviously, and I don't pretend that this is going to be an easy solution, but we could inspire a sense of duty to your country, to your family, to your neighbors, to your community by wearing a mask. And that's a good feeling to inspire. We can also inspire feelings of patriotism by wearing a mask. We can also inspire feelings that on a more negative side of disgust, maybe, that if you're not wearing a mask, that you could be potentially exposing yourself to disease. We could inspire feelings of fear. We could inspire feelings of maybe even peer pressure, or even sometimes, in appropriate terms, a lot of leadership by example and peer pressure is mixed up together in a very complex set of emotions for human beings. The point I'm making generally, and I'm really sorry for this long answer, is that if the policy objective is to get people to wear face masks, we may be using, if we use a law, it may be using a hammer or a nuclear bomb in order to kill an ant. And we may have better, more durable solutions to get people to wear face masks.
Yeah, and just really jumping off that point, right, it seems like perhaps the stick approach might be too difficult, but using a carrot, maybe using incentives for people to wear masks, are there any options there that we could explore besides tapping into the complex emotions of, you know, doing right by your community?
That's a great point. And yes, there are carrots and sticks and the incentives and disincentives to human behavior. And there's an entire field of human study called behavioral economics and behavioral psychology that is now merging with public health to change behaviors. So yes, I would say that there are definitely incentives. For example, we could incentivize people by making a mask-wearing contest. And we can use children to incentivize their parents to wear masks. We can also say, in order to attend or rather to enter a public space, it's not that masks are mandatory, but it's not a law in Malaysia, but rather as a prerequisite for you to enter, say, a public space. Or we could just create a competition, see who can design the most viral video of you putting on a mask. And I think these are incentives that the government of Malaysia and the public health functions in Malaysia can definitely explore.
Recently, the Health DG cited concerns about the number of returnees who haven't done their second testing before they finish their home quarantine. And the latest clusters are attributed to imported cases. Do you think more stringent measures regarding returnees are needed to curb new transmissions as well as border control?
Short answer to that is yes. However, it's not so much stricter as a blanket strictness, but rather more targeted levels of strictness. The reasons why we may need more targeted levels of strictness, let me arbitrarily divide them into returnees from high-risk countries and returnees from low-risk countries. However you define high-risk and low-risk, and that's an entirely separate conversation. If you come back from a high-risk country and or we're not certain that you'll be able to quarantine effectively, then we may need to put you into a government facility where we can monitor, or into a hotel. And only in the last 4 months of our MCO, we've had four different models in Malaysia, starting firstly with when you come home, you can quarantine at home, then quarantine into government facilities, and then quarantine into hotels, and now again quarantine at home with additional stringent measures. Now, with these four models that we've had only in the last 3 to 4 months, especially if we start opening our borders and we have travel bubbles, not only with Singapore, but also with other ASEAN countries and with the rest of the world, we can't keep our borders closed forever. And if we continue reopening our borders gradually or quickly, we may need more targeted quarantine measures divided into people who come back from high-risk countries or low-risk countries.
Right, and domestically, news portals have found that the level of complacence has increased. And there's been more crowding, for instance, and more people have stopped wearing masks. What can be done to address this gap, I guess? Overall, it seems like the attitudes have just become a bit more lax.
This is true. The newspaper reports and social media anecdotes and I guess stories from personal observation and also what you hear from your friends and the family from different parts of Malaysia indicate that this is true. However, obviously, we don't have the data to back this up. And even if we do conduct lots and lots of research to prove that people are more complacent, these researchers will definitely be very subjective. And I think that's one challenge. I think a second challenge is that human beings, until the 25th of January, which is when we had our first case in Malaysia, and the 18th of March, which is when the MCO started, we've always operated with, let me use the term, absolute freedom. We didn't have to worry about where we went, and we don't have to worry about transmissions and infectious diseases. And that kind of absolute freedom abruptly ended overnight on the 18th of March. And you can see that human beings are not used to the deprivation of freedoms, which is why it's very difficult to create a new set of behaviors and practices for them. Those are the two challenges, a dearth of data as well as our decades-long experience with absolute freedom that makes it difficult for us to adhere to new practices. So those are the challenges. What can we do to overcome these two challenges, which are very large challenges, is leadership by example, which I've mentioned earlier. Number two, a suite of solutions of disincentives and incentives, sometimes small, sometimes big, sometimes using the correct use of emotions, for us to adhere to this new normal. And thirdly, also repeated reminders from political leaders, from health leaders, from doctors, trusted professionals, also people in the community. I'm afraid there's no easy solution to this, except repeated reminders for us to get used to a new normal that's, shall we say, halfway between the MCO of no freedoms and the old normal of 100% freedoms. We will never be able to achieve 100% freedoms until a vaccine comes. But if you don't want to go back to 0% freedoms, then we must accept that we can live with 50% freedoms, and 50% is just an arbitrary number, just to get people to understand the concept, for the coming few years until we get a vaccine.
Now, there's a lot of conversations about reopening international borders, and I guess one of the government's priorities is reopening the Malaysia-Singapore border, which we'll know by August. What preparations should be made as we move towards reopening those borders with Singapore and other countries?
The Malaysia-Singapore border, I think, is a crucial border for both Malaysia and Singapore as well, in economic terms, trade terms, but also livelihoods, as well as the family ties between Singaporeans and Malaysians. Eventually, Malaysia will have to open our borders to the likes of Indonesia and Thailand, which we also have a lot of familial ties, economic ties, labor ties, and so on. Also, with other countries further afield, like China and Japan, and Australia, New Zealand, and the rest of the world. So what do we need to do? A few things. The first thing is to proceed with bilateral arrangements before we think about multilateral arrangements. What I mean to say is, even though Malaysia and Singapore share a very close historical, political, social relationship with each other, the creation of the RGL, Reciprocal Green Lane, and the PCA, or Periodic Commuting Arrangement, between Malaysia and Singapore is already so complex. Now, if we learn lessons from a bilateral arrangement with Singapore first, we can then proceed on to multilateral arrangements with other countries. So my first thought would be to proceed slowly and not to be too ambitious and not to open up the borders too quickly, because that will require a lot of work in the background. The second thought that I would have is to buttress or strengthen ASEAN infrastructure. What I mean to say is that ASEAN, the secretariat in Jakarta, needs to take greater leadership to build the infrastructure and the institutions to convene discussions on a Southeast Asian safe travel zone. Now, when we add a third country like Brunei or Thailand or Indonesia into the mix, we need a neutral arbiter to act as a convener so that these discussions can take place. And the neutral convener, the best one for us at the moment, is the ASEAN Secretariat. The third idea, and I'll probably stop here at the moment, is the harmonization of standards and regulatory standards between these countries. So any two countries, like Malaysia and Singapore, will have a first mover advantage. If Malaysia and Singapore were to harmonize our regulatory arrangements, and we are the, shall we say, the first set of countries in the world to have this harmonized regulatory arrangement, then other countries will feel that they are easier for them to follow the arrangements that have been set by Malaysia and Singapore. To date, there are very few approved and implemented travel arrangements Singapore and China has one. The Baltic countries of Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania have one. And the European Union has the beginnings of one. But other than that, there are very few countries with reciprocal arrangements. So Malaysia and Singapore's arrangement will be one of the first few. And if we can harmonize our regulatory arrangements quicker, it can be a model for other countries. And we will gain a first mover advantage. And we may even be able to advise other countries.
Dr. Kaur, one last question before we let you go. And those are amazing gains, and I can't wait to honestly see them, you know, just in terms of what the example that we can set for other nations. But at the same time, I think for people to be able to finally reconnect with their loved ones in either nations, what obstacles do you foresee with these green travel bubbles?
The first one is the definitions. The second one is the regulatory arrangements. There are many other challenges, but let me address this too. The first one is definitions, meaning at the moment, the Malaysian government and the Singaporean government on paper in the public domain, and obviously they will have private discussions to which I am not privy to, and we're not privy to because they will be announced in due course. But in the public domain, there is not yet any clear definition of what is essential business, for example. So what's essential business to Singapore may not be essential business to Malaysia. Number two, the definition for terms, for example. So is 3 months the correct length of time before you're allowed back into another country? Between Malaysia and Singapore, why not 6 weeks? Why not 2 cycles of 14 weeks, which is the incubation period of COVID? So it could be 28 days, for example. So this, unless we arrive at a clear definition, we will not be able to proceed with the RGL and PCA. And clear definition will be, I guess, the devil's in the details, and definitions is the first one. The second challenge is regulatory harmonization. So what, a crucial example would be this. The test kits that Malaysia uses will not be the same as the test kit that Singapore uses. Mm-hmm. And we're not even getting into the conversation about antigen versus antibody, which test do you use, and at what point do you deploy this test, and which companies are providing this test, even the way in which you take the nasal swabs and the throat swabs for this test. Now, that's just one example of the regulatory harmonization that needs to take place. And until and unless both governments can agree to this, we will not be able to move ahead with RGL and PCA. Other examples of regulatory harmonization would be the laboratory networks, also the surveillance networks, also the criteria for automatic exits. What I mean to say is that each of these are separate regulatory hurdles in the laboratory science, in the pathology science, also in the test kit science. But the last one that I mentioned is about automatic exits. Mm-hmm. Now, if we sign an RGL and a PCA agreement with Singapore, under what circumstances do we break the agreement, either on our side or on their side? And what are the legal instruments that we will sign between the government of Malaysia and the Republic of Singapore that allows, say, mediation, arbitration, or I don't know, is there a need for us to provide a way for us to resolve disputes? And these are behind-the-scenes challenges, which are not as easy as we might as they might appear.
Dr. Kaur, thank you so much again for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
That was physician and health policy specialist Dr. Kaur Swee King. We're now headed to the 5:30 news. This is the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.